The advice and recommendations in this program are for general educational purposes and not a diagnosis. You should consult a physician or health professional before beginning or changing any course of health treatment. From the studios of News Talk 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall at cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 846 of Sunday House Call for this August the 14th, 2022. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. We're broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk 580 CFRA here in Ottawa and taking your calls shortly at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is the long distance number, and you can send your comments and questions. Text us at 580-580. I want to talk about the bugaboo of the week, the word that creates a Pavlovian response and prevents people from actually having a civil discussion about it. And the word that's being bandied about this week is privatization. We haven't really defined what that means, but the response is one that is Pavlovian in nature. You hear the word and people go crazy over it on either side of the spectrum. So if we're going to talk about something like this, the first thing that we should recognize is that there are some that will, and I'm not referring to my listeners or listeners to the show, but just in general, what we see in terms of the response and the arguments that keep coming up without very much evidence, and yet is used as a bludgeon to stop people from trying to talk about ways to solve the healthcare system problems. And one is first to stop casting aspersions on healthcare providers' professionalism and desire to provide quality care. I don't care how we go about covering the cost for universal coverage, but there are different ideas out there on how to do that. And the main goal is to provide care, not to make more money, but to provide care. The other is not to score political points instead of having a civil discussion about the various options to provide universal health care. Right? So there's always politics involved with this, and teams are set up, and no one listens to each other. They just talk at each other. And let's deal with the hypocrisy first, because we need to get that out of the way. And our system is rife with hypocrisy. And I've mentioned this before. The same people who have strong responses against the notion of privatization, I'm going to get into what I think it means, but let's just leave it at that for a moment. People that are arguing against it and people that argue for it. A lot of them have, especially if they're in government or they're in professional associations, have healthcare insurance. Healthcare insurance that covers them for private services. And the list goes on and on. Massage therapy, physiotherapy, dental, glasses, psychology, psychologist services, walking aids, canes, burn products, all kinds of stuff, right? I mean, you just look at an insurance plan and see what it covers. And that's all covered. And yet there are those that don't have insurance plans that can't get that. So you already have that aspect. And I doubt you would see anybody who's arguing against privatization or for privatization wanting to give up their insurance plan. So that's the first hypocrisy. The second, and there's so many, I'm just giving a few examples. The Worker Safety and Insurance Board pays hospitals for access to MRIs for people that have been injured to get them ahead in order to be assessed more quickly. So getting public hospitals to provide the care, and I don't blame them because they want their clients to be treated and healed and get back to work if possible. So that's what they do. You get injured, not part of the WSIB, and you're going to wait, and you're going to wait, and you're going to wait. In our public system right now for family practice, you have different practice organizations. They all have different acronyms. One is called FHOs or FOs, Family Health Organizations. Another one is Family Health Teams or FHTs or FITs. You have FIGs. You have independent physicians just working not under any group. But let me tell you that when you compare, for example, a family health organization, which is what my practice, along with our 14 physicians and six nurses have, versus a family health team, is that the family health team has provided more funding to provide nurse practitioners and ancillary staff and support staff, and provides a broader coverage of care with ancillary and allied health professionals compared to a family health organization. They're both covered by the government. They're both covered by your taxes. Yet if you are in a FO, you do not get the same level of services that you would if you were in a FIT. And they're both public. So you have two-tier built into the public system already. And if we wanted to do that, we'd have to sign bureaucratic contracts and do all kinds of stuff with more government oversight. And you know how that works. So that's another part of our healthcare system. So those are some of the hypocrisies that are in there. And also, if we're going to talk about universal health care, exclude the United States. Just get rid of it, because that's not a universal system. Compare it to other systems. So if we do, for example, and we cover Germany and Canada, Germany that has 75 million people, Canada about 38 million, so they have double the amount of people in Germany. And you look at the healthcare bureaucracy in Germany versus Canada. And this comes from the Frontier Center for Public Policy. It was published in the Calgary Herald in January of this year. They covered the healthcare system in quite a long piece. Bureaucrats. In Canada, you have one healthcare bureaucrat for every 1,415 Canadians. In Germany, you have one healthcare bureaucrat for every 15,545 Germans. So 10 times less. So the money that they put in, and they spend about the same amount of money, Germany does, and Canada in terms of healthcare system. But if you have 10 times less bureaucrats, you have a lot more money in that pool to actually provide care and services. So if you're looking to say, where can extra money come from to help provide more in our healthcare system, that's certainly one way to do that. Not the only way, but certainly another way to do that. And Germany has, in terms of OECD data, which looks at the efficacy and rankings of healthcare system, Germany is closer to the top, Canada is closer to the bottom. So let's deal with also some of the other things. And there's a lot to cover, and I may bring some points up throughout the show. The first is pay the nurses appropriately. Get rid of the bill that is limiting their fee increases by 1% and pay them what they deserve, and they deserve a lot more. And also provide support services for them so they don't burn out. I have a lot of nurses in my practice, emergency room nurses, CCU or coronary care unit use nurses, ICU nurses, and they invariably tell me that they are burning out. Some have burnt out and they were given time off in order to recuperate. And these are nurses with decades of experience. So they know what's going on. They know what is needed to be able to maintain their ability to provide care and also not to break down. So that's one aspect of things. The other canard, and this is what we call my view of privatization. My practice is a private company. I own the company along with one of my colleagues. We set it up 30 years ago, this coming November 28th. It'll be 30 years. It does what every other corporation does. It pays staff, salaries, taxes, supplies, rent, everything that needs to be done. It gets that income from the billings of the physicians. And that's how it works. It's private. I own it. But it's private, but it's covered by your OHIP card. You're not paying anything more to use the service. And that's the same thing you have when you go get a blood test. Or you go to an imaging center. Use your health card. You get your x-ray, your ultrasound, bone density, mammogram, whole host of things, Dopplers, echocardiograms, all covered. There's a fantastic cardiovascular center that I use extensively, the Ottawa Cardiovascular Center on Bank near Riverside, that has all the equipment to do all the testing for cardiovascular disease assessments and all kinds of stuff. Cardiologists are there, internists are there, nurses are there. You go with your OHIP card, it's all covered. But it's private. So the idea that private means poor care or somehow that you're going to be outlaying money doesn't hold any water. The other issue is that we need to remove some of the barriers for access. And that's part of the issue too, getting access, getting a family doctor, being able to access services more quickly. Why is it that MRIs cannot be set up in satellite areas, just like you have imaging centers all around town that offer x-rays and ultrasounds? Why can't they add an MRI? Because the government won't let them. They need to have a specific license to do so. And they're not allowed to do that. If you can use your OHIP card in the hospital to get your MRI, why can't you use your OHIP card to get an MRI at a private center? If the private center is not able to provide it, they won't have it. But if they're able to set up a business plan where it actually covers, they can figure out that your OHIP card and the amount they get paid for it and such can cover it, why not? Faster care, faster assessment, know what we can do to help you if we know what the MRI tells us. The government can contribute also, just like they do for hospitals in terms of funding. So there are ways to do this. With regards to family practice, there are two choices. One is increase the amounts that go to family practice for administrative services. This is not asking to pay physicians more, and I want to be very clear about that. Excuse me. It has nothing to do with that. The physicians are paid independently. They're paid through OHIP independently. They're independent contractors in our practice. And we provide services to them so that they can practice as they see fit. We work together as a cohesive group. And yet they pay a certain percentage of their income into the practice so we can cover the costs that I mentioned earlier about what our business has to do. But that is becoming more and more difficult with inflationary pressures, with the need to continue to pay our employees and our staff adequately, stay above what we consider to be living wage and actually make it more than that. Provide the support systems for everybody so that they can function well and be able to provide care to our patients. And also to have their well-being maintained as well and not get burned out. And as it stands now, that ability to do so is being heavily strained. It's being heavily strained because the income coming into the practice is not keeping pace with the demands of services, inflation, cost of everything. It just isn't doing that. And there is no means today to be able to compensate for that. And as you know, if you're running anything, even your home, if you have less money coming in and your expenses continue to increase, you have to cut back. And that's what's starting to happen. So there are two choices. One, the government can decide by cutting the 9 out of 10 healthcare bureaucrats from their payrolls and divert that to patient care and increase the funding so that we can provide these services. Or, and as I mentioned earlier, you have co-payments as you do in other countries around the world. Germany, France, UK, all kinds of countries have small co-payments. Now, you can certainly say that for people that are below a certain income line, no co-payment. But if you're above a certain income line, $5, maybe $10, what does that $5 or $10 get for you? Well, what it amounts to is that it would allow us, one, to ensure that our nurses, staff, are adequately remunerated and paid. They have healthcare plans that we cover. We instituted healthcare plans for our staff quite a few years ago, and we cover the cost of that for them. It allows us to hire a nurse practitioner who can then start seeing more patients, alleviating some of the strain on the physicians that are trying to see everybody. Physician assistant that can help physicians also in the same way and also do some of the paperwork. It also would allow us to hire a locum, that is a physician who covers for other physicians over the course of the year, providing even more care. But really, we can't do any of that yet because there's nothing available. You cannot have a co-payment. It's against the law. You can't do that. The government is not providing any substantive increase. So again, remember, the revenue that comes to our practice is through the physicians' billings. So physicians got a 1% increase in fees this year. 1%. Inflation is 7% or 8%. So that's the business aspect of things. And that's private company. That's just the way it works. So we have to think of different ways to provide care and also determine where we want those dollars to go. As our population gets older, the proportion of healthcare dollars and the greatest proportion is spent during the final years of people's lives. And you want to ensure that they have the dignity and respect as you treat them to not suffer. And so you have a finite pool of resources. You have finite one taxpayer, finite amount of money. You have to decide on how you're going to apportion that. You also want to think of how you can improve efficiencies in provision of services. And human beings, being what they are, respond to incentives. And if you look at some other countries where they have what's known as patient-centered funding, what does that mean? Patient-centered funding means that you control the money. Each person gets a certain allotment of funds, either through their insurance that is covered for you, or through OHIP, which provides that funding. Except you can decide where you're going to spend that money, meaning that hospitals would no longer get a global budget, where every patient that comes into the hospital is considered to be a burden on that budget. Instead, hospitals will be working hard to get you to come to them because that's the only way that they will earn income, is through your decision to go there. And your decision to go there is also going to be based on how well the hospital performs. In France, they have websites where you can look up specialty hospitals, how well they do, patient satisfaction, outcomes, complications, all kinds of stuff. And the competition in and of itself through the public system, the competition because of how the funding is arranged, improves services, improves outcomes. Because the motivation is if we don't perform well, we're not going to have people come see us. So again, there are many different ways to look at how to do things. The canard, for example, of setting up private surgical centers, that somehow you're going to take surgeons away from the hospitals. Well, let's look at that for a moment, and then we're going to go to the break. Right now, the reality is that surgeons do not get enough OR time, operating room time, to see their patients at the existing hospitals now in Ontario. So resources and time are being wasted because a surgeon is sitting in their office instead of doing surgery, what they've been trained to do. And that's only getting worse. So what is to say that you can't set up or have a group of physicians or surgeons or whomever decide they want to set up a surgical center? And with your OHIP card, you go to the surgical center to get things done. Are you taking surgeons away from the hospital? No, because they don't have that OR time in the hospital to begin with. So now they're creating more time. Now, granted, you're not going to be able to do all kinds of surgeries you have in the hospital. There's different complications and things that are associated with that. But there certainly is room to create surgical centers where you can go to, where the surgeon, instead of sitting in their office, now is able to actually practice their craft and help people. They're still at the hospital when their OR time is available, but now they have extra OR time available elsewhere, outside of the hospital, could be a private center, and yet you're using your OHIP card. So again, these are some of the things that where you say privatization is bad. I don't see how that's the case if you're still using your OHIP card, and if there is a business case for doing it where you allow people to innovate and see how they can provide that with the OHIP card, and the government provides adequate remuneration for those services, it's a win-win for everybody. Anyway, there's some of the points. I know I've gone on for quite some time, and my apologies, but I just wanted to bring some of these points across because we can have a reasonable discussion about this and make changes to the system that don't blow it up and yet allow us to be able to provide more care. And that's ultimately what this is about, because the way we're going and the way the discussion goes, when you even try to talk about changes and people explode and just bluster, it doesn't help anything. I've seen this for 30 years now with the same kind of answer. And look where we've gotten, look where we've headed, and look what's happening. So we got to take our head out of the sand, look reasonably at what other universal healthcare systems do in the world, and ask what works best in those areas. Can we adapt them here? How can we gradually institute that and not lose our heads and salivate like Pavlov's dogs whenever the term privatization comes up? Appreciate your comments and questions. We're going to take a small break and come back with your calls shortly. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. Back in a few minutes.
A little song I wrote, you might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry, be happy. In every life we have some trouble, but when you worry you make it double. Don't worry.
Mercedes ruling a ring.
521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number, and you can text us your comments and questions at 580-580. And some very patient people who've been waiting. Sorry I went on for so long, but I feel really so frustrated. But we're going to go to John in Ottawa. Hi, John.
Oh, hi, Doctor. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome.
I enjoyed that talk. Food for thought, for sure. Oh,
thank you.
That'll be interesting to see how that develops. But anyways, that, I guess that's for another conversation.
Sure.
quickly, my question is, I recently had a talk to my pharmacist about the medication I'm taking these days. And I was surprised by a couple of things. One thing, he advised I take statins before bed. And which is great. I never knew that, but which I've started to do.
Sure.
But I'm curious as to, I'm going for 3 months on the other side of the world.
Yeah.
So as far as sleep goes, and this, for instance, this medication, as far as the circadian rhythm and all of that stuff.
Sure.
How's that going to, how long does it take for it to come back? I'm going to go over there. Is that going to mess with things?
Well, yes, and that's a great question, John. So, yes, so there are certain medications that where timing is important in that when we talk about how medications work, there's a term that's called pharmacokinetics. Pharmaco refers to the drug. Kinetics is the movement or activity. And it's how the body processes the drug and how quickly the drug reaches a level in your bloodstream that provides the effect that you want. And so there are some medications where taking at night tends to provide either a better response or reduces potential for side effects because you tend to be sleeping through the night. Now, with regards to circadian rhythm, when you travel, it takes, you know, depending on how far you're going and the extent to which the time zone has changed, it can take, you know, up to a week for you to resume your normal activity. But even then, especially with a statin, there's really not much that's going to impact your overall health or therapeutic effect over that week, especially if you're still taking it every day. So once you finally are able to get to sleep at night with it following the normal time zone there, it should return pretty much to normal in terms of you taking the medication at night. So it's not an urgent or something where the medication doesn't work. It's just simply that they find that when you take it at a certain time of day, the pharmacokinetics of it tend to be a bit better. But that being said, it's not anything where you have to be overly concerned that if you're taking it, you know, 5 hours earlier than you used to, until you're able to get to sleep properly, that somehow it's not going to help you. It still will help you.
Yeah, I was never really concerned before, but the more I read on it, the more interesting it was. I was just curious, really.
Yeah, and there's other things, like, for example, medications to reduce acid in your stomach, people that have reflux disease or GERD.
I'm on that one,
yeah,
too.
And it's recommended to take the medications in the evening or towards the nighttime before you go to bed. And
right.
The reason is that our stomachs produce more acid when you sleep at night. And so if you take the medications towards the evening, the peak effect of the medications happens at a time where the peak effect of the acid production would occur, so you get less acid production. So that's another reason where that timing is. Same thing for blood pressure medications. When you take blood pressure medications, usually recommended to take it at night, not because nighttime is very when you're sleeping, it's not a huge deal because blood pressure drops. It's that when you look at the statistics for heart attack, most heart attacks occur when people wake up in the morning. And why does that happen? Because their blood pressure spikes in the morning when you get up. And so by taking the blood pressure medication at night, you blunt that spiking in the morning, so it reduces the risk of heart attack.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
I love it. Okay.
All right, John.
That's really cool. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. We're going to go to line two and speak to Anne in Cornwall. Hi, Anne.
Oh, hi. I'm so glad to talk to you again. Long time.
Yeah.
Okay. Listen, ask CFRA to have a program with a lot of different actors in the situation and getting the different points of view. Like, what you worked, you're talking about is a certain amount of money. Like, I have insurance for dental, right?
Yes.
Or I used to.
Yeah.
And I could choose braces or you know, an implant or something.
Sure.
The thing is, there's really no oversight. you know, not like if I go to a public hospital, I feel like I, you know, there's more way to follow, I guess, malpractice. You know. Anyway, that's not why I called.
Oh no, that's okay. And, but actually, no, there is always oversight. So, for example, in our practice, which I mean, it's a private practice, right? But there's regulations, right? CPSO,
yes, right,
stuff, and as physicians, we have to fulfill certain guidelines and maintain quality of care and standards of care. And we have public health that comes in to look at our refrigerators and ensure that the vaccines are kept at the proper temperature, and we have to report the temperatures to public health. So there's a lot. Your point is well taken, that regulation is very important, but there's nothing to say you can't regulate, right? That's the issue.
They haven't done it in the dental sector. Anyway, I don't want to go rabbit hole right now. There's so many different things, and certainly I know doctors are not paid. I mean, I know my husband made an hourly wage. You know, he worked a regular day,
sure,
and he made more per hour than our doctor did.
Right.
So, I mean, that's not great, right? But we have to start training more doctors, too.
Sure.
The thing is that, I don't want to cause a riot. I've been wondering, there was a program, it was a fictional program, and it was about smallpox,
yeah,
and the doctor was trying to find out the source of the contamination, because, through the weeks, certain people were becoming sick, and he didn't know why, because
mm-hmm.
he was in England, right?
Yeah.
And anyway, the point is, I thought, wow, is monkeypox like this? And finally,
you're talking about Jon Snow, who found cholera in London.
This was like the Indian doctor. This is the name of the program. It was a series.
Sure.
But the thing is, so last week there was PBS again. They were interviewing a healthcare person, and she said it can be transmitted through bedding.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm planning to go to a tourist hotel, and should I bring my own bedding?
it's a great question. So for monkeypox, the most common, so during the 2022 outbreak, so this outbreak, what they have found is that there are several ways that you can contract or be exposed to monkeypox. The most common, and I really mean the most common, is person to person. That is direct contact with someone who is infected, body fluids and such, and that is the most common way. Now, it can be also if there's fluids on a surface. So, for example, something that has touched an infected person, so that can be clothing or bedding or other objects, it is possible for it to be spread to others who touch the items. So yes, you're absolutely right. Also can happen from tiny droplets from the lungs, but you have to be in very close proximity to the person, sort of face to face. So either kissing or cuddling, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So yes, you're right. That being said, the question is, what are the practices in the hotel that you're going to? Are they changing the bedding and cleaning everything up? If they are, then your risk is going to be minimal because you're removing whatever is covering the area.
In the old days, didn't they burn everything?
I don't know. Not good for the climate to do that.
No, I don't want to do it either. I don't have that many clothes. But the point is that, what kind of soap would be the best to use? I'm not washing the sheets in a hotel, but, if I brought my own sheets and I brought them home,
regular washing, if you wanted, you could use bleach as well. A lot of the detergents that are used now are not just regular detergent anymore. There's enzymatic compounds that break down fats and proteins and all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so usually if you're washing things pretty thoroughly, your risk is going to be extremely low. But it's a great question, Anne. It's a really good question because when you are traveling, it's something to think about.
Oh, thank you. But should I just ask the hotel what they're using for their
Sure. You can say, they have check-in times and check-out times because usually they are changing everything in order to do that.
Uh-huh.
So as long as they're doing that, you should be okay. If you're comfortable putting an extra sheet down, you can certainly ask them to bring you a new sheet, and you can do that too. I mean, whatever makes you comfortable.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. And
You're welcome,
we need more discussion because I remember when Kathleen Wynne was in, she was investing in technology and everybody was saying, oh, all medicine, and you know what? Then Kevin Page said that the Harper government did not gives it was shortchanging the province for transfers for health. So, I mean, you know, it also it has to do with people willing to pay taxes, has to do with the government putting those taxes in health care. That's what I think.
It is, although I got to tell you, when the Wynn government decided to cut the health care funding for EMRs after they promised physicians that they would cover the cost and then left us with a $60,000 a year extra cost that with nothing to compensate for it, wasn't too appreciated either.
Well, I don't blame you. Okay.
All right, Anne.
It's so complicated. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Take care. We are going to go to line three and speak to Roland. Hi, Roland.
Hi, doctor.
How are you?
I'm not too good. I'm just got a quick question. I'm
sure.
A long-time listener. I'm scheduled for an MRI, and I told them I couldn't take it because I got a claustrophobic problem. Now, they said, well, we can give you a pill. Well, I had that once before. And I was in the machine for about maybe a minute or so, and I was soaking wet, and my heart was just jumping out of my chest.
Right.
So I'm just wondering, can they put you to sleep for an MRI?
So they can increase the dose of the sedative, right? So if they gave you a small amount of medication, you probably didn't have enough to make you feel calmed down. So there are different doses. You may want to speak to your physician about that and what dose they used. Because a lot of times they'll use something like, for example, lorazepam, and they'll give someone half a milligram. And that, for many people, is not enough to calm them down. So the point is that there likely is medication at the right dose that will certainly calm you down. You may even fall asleep when you take it. But there certainly are options to help you be able to get that MRI, but it likely was just an incomplete dose that was given to you to help you out.
So if I refuse to take it, is a radiologist?
Yeah, the radiologist is the person that will read the MRI. It's usually the technicians that are there that are doing the MRI. They're doing the whole procedure. But there is, I would speak to your physician, though, and you can say, look, is there a medication you can give me so I can take it before I go in for my MRI? And I do that with some of my patients. Same thing for the same reason that people who have, when they go on a plane and they get scared or anxiety when they're on a plane, I give them a medication that helps them sleep or even calms them down and they're able to take the flight. So it's very similar in terms of the response.
Yeah, okay. I'm just wondering because I know, I even get it in elevators and...
Yeah. But there is, like I said, there are medications that can help. In order to be sedated to the point that you're sleeping, usually it implies different medications that usually require an anesthesiologist to monitor you because there are certain medications that you just can't give someone and say, okay, this is going to make you... sleep, you have to be monitored. And so, for example, someone that's going for a procedure, you know, they're going for a colonoscopy or an endoscopy, and they are given a propofol, which is a medication that knocks them out, but there's an anesthesiologist that's there that monitors them because of the dangers of not that medication if you're not monitoring someone. You have to make sure that they're okay and that they're responding well. Whereas there are other medications that you can give someone by tablet form that you know won't do that, that may make them fall asleep, but certainly will make them feel much calmer, but it can be a dose-related phenomenon. So it really is a matter of finding the right dose to be able to provide that person with enough of an effect so that they don't feel anxious or claustrophobic when they're doing the MRI.
Okay. They've already sent me a little bottle with three pills in it. But I don't know the name of them right now.
Yeah, so you may want to speak to your physician and just ask them, you know, mention the medication and the dosing that's on it, and they may want to either alter the dose or say that's a good enough dose if you take all three tablets. But that you have to speak to your physician about.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Roland. All the best to you. Good luck.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye now. We're going to take a small break. And come back with your calls. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you're listening to Sunday House Call. Back in a few minutes.
I gotta give myself.
advice and recommendations in this program are for general educational purposes and not a diagnosis. You should consult a physician or health professional before beginning or changing any course of health treatment.
Talk 520-255 star 580 on Bell Mobility. 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number, and comments and questions at 580-580. We have one. Joanne writes, I have two complete tendon tears in my shoulder and waiting for a consult with an orthopedic surgeon, but I'm told could be months. Also overdue for a mammogram, but cannot lift my arm. Is there an option to a mammogram or adjustments that can be made? So, Joanne, there likely is, because there are people, for example, who may be paralyzed or have had injuries where they cannot move their arm as much. And that really is the radiology center that can accommodate. So you can let them know that there's an injury, and they usually can accommodate to be able to complete the mammogram as best they can, because there are, as you know, there are many people who suffer with all kinds of injuries and who may not be able to lift their arm up as well as others. And so there usually is some means to be able to do the mammogram to a certain degree, as opposed to postponing it altogether. And I hope you get those tendons looked at. One of the things about tendon injuries, especially if they're acute, meaning that they've happened recently, if you speak to your physician or family doctor, I'm assuming they made the referral to the orthopedic surgeon, there are also interim measures you can take. So, for example, I also like to use sports medicine physicians and send patients there when they have these tears or damage, because they can also make an assessment. They can also help you determine if there's any therapies available in the interim. And they sometimes have links to orthopedic surgeons, or even have orthopedic surgeons on staff linked to their centers that they can consult. The other option as well, depending on the degree of dysfunction that you're having in your shoulder, is that sometimes electronic consults can be made. So this is a system that actually works quite well, and I have to give kudos to our provincial health departments here for doing this in terms of making things more accessible, is that your physician can make a consult directly to an orthopedic surgeon, include the imaging studies and a description of the difficulties that you're having. And sometimes the surgeon can give recommendations within a few days, as opposed to waiting months, within a few days of knowing, providing your physician with some options. And sometimes also is able to say, okay, well, we'll refer them to this department and we might be able to see the patient. So that is another means of trying to get access to services. Certainly doesn't put you ahead of the line. You're just using the system and the services that are available that can, and again, the idea is to provide care to people. So it's electronic consults or e-consults or sports medicine referral. Those two options, if they haven't been done, might help you get seen by the orthopedic surgeon more quickly than the situation that you're in now. We're going to go to line one and speak to Helen. Hello, Helen.
Yes.
Hi.
Good afternoon, Dr. Dworkin.
How are you?
Pretty good. Yourself?
I'm fine. Thank you.
The reason why I'm calling you is my husband has very dry skin,
yeah.
And we've been told to use a product that rhymes with Mera-V.
Okay. Yes.
I don't want anyone getting sued from CRTC. Anyway, he does that, but it's a heritage from his mom, like hereditary condition.
Yes.
Now, the thing is, I was thinking the Olympic swimmers, like their skin must be dry. What do they use on their bodies?
It depends on what they have, right? I mean, some people, if they have eczematous conditions or dry skin conditions, they may use topical steroid creams to try and reduce some of the dryness. But in terms of the emollients or moisturizers, yeah, the one that you mentioned, there's a whole bunch, right? There's Uramol, Eucerin, Spectroderm, Lubriderm. There's a whole bunch of them that can be used on the skin to keep skin moisturized, especially if you're in the water for a bit and when you come out. But if there are specific areas of the skin where it gets red, scaly, dry, then usually you're looking at using a topical steroid, an ointment usually. Ointments, moisturized creams will dry the skin. So depending on the area of the body. So
all
for example,
over his body.
Yeah.
And it's at the point where he scratches and like flakes come off.
Yeah,
and
so now has he had a diagnosis of his skin condition?
Yes, his GP sent him to a specialist and they said, oh, yeah, stick with that other product. And but I'm just thinking that maybe he needs something more strong.
I happen to agree with you. You may want to have him speak to his physician. There are especially if it's all over his body, there are steroid lotions which are easier to spread over the body surface, as opposed to trying to use an ointment where you're going to use half the tube to cover someone's body, which is not comfortable and not practical.
Yeah.
Whereas lotions will work and help alleviate, especially with the itching and scratching. The problem is you scratch the skin too much, you break the skin. If you break the skin, you can potentially cause secondary bacterial infections, and that's a whole other can of worms.
And we're no spring roosters and chicken here.
Yeah,
we're 81 and 70,
yeah,
so I'm worried about him like being exposed with all these viruses going around. As a matter of fact, we stopped swimming at a local pool because you you had to say how clean it is.
I know.
With all due respect, so we're just waiting for another pool to open up in October. But and I think, he was an avid swimmer and all this, and he enjoyed the sun, but now he's paying the price. So everybody wear their sunglasses and suntan lotion and cover up. But the skin condition, it's really bad. I'm actually yelling at him to stop scratching.
It's very difficult. When you're itchy, you want to scratch. But there are things that can be used. So if you have a chance this week to call this physician and just say, look, it certainly sounds, from what you're describing, it sounds like eczema, right? I mean, dry, scaly skin.
Mm-hmm.
There's no plaques, though, right? There's no whitish, thick plaque-like things on the skin?
Nothing
like
that? Okay. No, there isn't, no.
Okay, yeah, because that's usually when you see psoriasis. You tend to see these crusted, white, and they're literally white patches on the skin, whereas eczema tends to be dry, fine, scaly, red, very itchy. Allergies can also potentially do that, but again, if it's all over his body and it happens to be when he's swimming, then it's unlikely to be allergy-mediated, but more just a contact or irritative type of condition.
To the point where he doesn't need to take a shower. Like, he used to take a shower once a day, now he does two or three days because he says it's too itchy, afterwards.
Yeah.
And I put the cream on the other product and on his back and all that, but I'm thinking, like, maybe it's some kind of a medicine he needs, or maybe...
Yeah, he definitely needs a prescription lotion to help alleviate that, first of all, the scaliness, the itchiness, and the dryness, because the skin is hyperreactive, and that's why it's getting so itchy for him.
And even after seeing a specialist in the skin, a dermatologist, too, you think they would have suggested that at this point.
Yeah, I don't know what they said, so I can't comment on that. But,
she just commented using the same over-the-counter thing, but now it's at the point where he's scratching all the time.
Yeah, I think he needs to see his physician just to get something a little bit more effective to help alleviate his discomfort.
Well, thank you kindly, Dr. Dwork.
Oh,
I appreciate your information, and we'll hop on it tomorrow morning.
All right, my pleasure. You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. And I guess that about wraps up the show. My thanks to Ethan Fink for producing Sunday House Call. We'll be back next week with another edition. Thank you so much for your calls. Everyone, have a great week. But the risk of knowing that I love me soon.